This episode of New Politics was released on the 9th of July, 2022, and produced on the land of the Wangal and Whadjuk people.
Welcome to New Politics. In this episode, the Prime Minister getting attacked for just doing his job, factional trouble in the Liberal Party, how far away is the voice to Parliament, and who's got the mandate for climate change? I'm Eddie Djokovic, editor of New Politics.
I'm David Lewis, currently writing my notebooks from a prison in Italy.
And a big thank you to our new Patreon subscribers. Thanks for signing up. And if you'd like to support New Politics, you can support us through a Patreon subscription. It's just $5 per month for the Ruby Standard supporter level or $10 per month for the Gold Standard supporter level. But whether it's a subscription or if you just want to listen in, read our material online or buy a t-shirt or buy a book, it's all available at newpolitics.com.au. And all of this is a good way to support independent journalism. The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, has returned from Ukraine, and he's also returned to a media barrage of questions about whether he's spending too much time overseas. Last week, we did outline the amount of time that Albanese has spent overseas is about the same or less than his predecessors at the same time in their Prime Ministership, and that's Scott Morrison, Malcolm Turnbull and Tony Abbott. And Liberal Party and National Party MPs are now ramping up the pressure as well. Here's Angus Taylor trying to score political points but not doing a very good job of it.
But it is important that constituents know that people are on the job. And we hadn't heard from Anthony Albanese for 48 hours. As always, you want to know that these issues are being dealt with.
But do you accept visiting Ukraine's different to Hawaii and that he had to have radio silence for security reasons in Ukraine?
My issue wasn't with the travel. My issue was with dealing with the situation that we had on the ground in the Nepean Hawkesbury.
The leader of the National Party, David Littleproud, he's also been on the attack as well, suggesting that Labor endlessly criticised Scott Morrison for travelling to Hawaii, so it's only fair that Albanese be criticised for travelling overseas. But I would say that travelling to war-torn Ukraine after high-level meetings at NATO and offering solidarity with the Ukrainian people is a little bit different to Scott Morrison's secret family holiday to Hawaii when half of Australia was burning during the 2019 bushfire season.
Yeah, it's two completely different things. Prime Minister Albanese was working. Prime Minister Scott Morrison was on holidays. Now, I'm not saying that prime ministers aren't entitled to holidays, but as we've discussed before, in that job, holidays are a very temporary thing done when you hope that not much is going to happen. John Howard always holidayed in the quiet period of January, but to his credit, was always available if something was to go wrong. I think Scott Morrison went on six holidays a year somehow. He didn't announce all of them. Sometimes he did. If there was something coming up and it looked like the press was going to be after him, he'd tell them that he was going on holidays. He didn't always tell them where he was going to go. Again, most prime ministers will tell at least some of the press where they're going. And of course, there's nothing wrong in principle of going overseas on business and then tacking a couple of days on at the end, provided that's at your own expense. Again, prime ministers deserve holidays. Now, I think it's too early to say that Anthony Albanese deserved a holiday. He's only been in the job a couple of months, but he didn't take one. These high-level meetings were to start the rebuilding process from a trashed foreign policy and foreign relations from the previous government. And they were totally ruined. I'm sure that picture of the Macrons and Anthony Albanese and his partner laughing, I'm sure that laugh was 90% relief that Macron seems to be able to look past the fact that it wasn't Australia, it was the last government, and two, that the nerves that Prime Minister Albanese might have had for meeting someone who had been quite critical of the Australian government and who held the upper hand, really. Australia has had to do some hard work and pay some hefty I'll call them penalties, to get back into a decent international standing, that Anthony Albanese and Penny Wong too did that almost instantly, is to their credit, I think.
Well, it is that false equivalence that the media keeps pushing, and it's almost like, well, Scott Morrison was criticised when he went overseas, so therefore we'll criticise Anthony Albanese when he goes overseas. And the media has supposedly got its job to do, and that's to ask the questions of political leaders. But you have to ask, well, what is it that they're trying to achieve? And we do have to accept that legacy mainstream media is appealing more to an ageing and more conservative demographic these days than they used to, and that means it's going to favour conservative political parties, but it's becoming quite a tiresome narrative. And this process ends up becoming a bit of a feedback loop as well. Some media outlets start criticising Albanese, and then other media outlets amplify this by saying Albanese is defending these criticisms when most people are not actually that concerned about it. And comparing Anthony Albanese and Scott Morrison, well, that's going to be an obvious choice to make. Albanese is the new Prime Minister. Morrison was the previous Prime Minister just a few months ago, but it's trying to compare apples with oranges. Morrison was in COVID isolation during the last round of floods earlier this year in Lismore, so that's fair enough, but he didn't delegate any responsibilities to anyone. He decided that he was the only one who could act on the matter, didn't release any financial support for several weeks, and when that financial support did arrive, it was targeted towards Liberal and National Party held seats. Morrison also tried to score political points and was at loggerheads with the New South Wales government about the release of funds and the course of action that should have been taken at that time. In comparison, Albanese was in Ukraine when the recent floods commenced, but the responsibilities were delegated to the Minister for Emergency Management, and that's Murray Watt. Albanese has now visited the flood-affected areas. The financial support has already started flowing within a couple of days, and he's teamed up with the Premier of New South Wales, Dominic Perrottet, to work out solutions to this emergency situation. And these actions flow into what Albanese promised during the recent federal election campaign, that he wanted to see cooperative federalism. And that's exactly what he's doing at the moment. So whether you support Morrison or whether you support Albanese, it's obvious that the results have been quite different this time around. But this doesn't seem to be enough for the media. It's almost like they're more interested in a Prime Minister who cooks curries and provides for endless photo opportunities rather than a Prime Minister who actually does his job.
More cynical people might suggest that the press is not used to actually having to work, to find out things, to analyse things, to understand complex policy, rather than somebody getting dressed up and inviting them to little junkets and having fun. Now, I'm not really criticising anyone for preferring a fun job than a work job, but I can't help but feel that I'm enjoying politics a lot more now that I've got something substantial to dig into than I did 6 months ago when it was, here's another Matt Canavan photo up where he's dressed up as a miner, as if he's ever done a hard day's work in his life. It's insulting to those who have. Here's another Scott Morrison pretending to be a hairdresser with all the issues around that. So I suspect that there is a, and again, I must be perfectly clear, not all the press could point to, you know, maybe even a dozen journalists who are probably in the same position as us at the moment, who are saying, thankfully, we have something that we can dig our teeth into and be journalists with. But I think there's probably some younger journalists and some older lazy ones who are missing the whole gotcha journalism, who are missing the whole, oh, here's the Prime Minister dressed up. We don't get to ask the hard questions, but that's okay. And of course, this suits media proprietors who are quite happy trying to control the narrative. And I think what the last election taught us is that they lost the narrative. That's the tragedy in their eyes, and it's the triumph in everybody else's eyes.
Oh, well, we criticise the mainstream media or the legacy media quite frequently on New Politics, but the other fact is that not everyone gets their news from the mainstream media these days. So the influence of the mainstream media has been diminishing over the years, and especially younger demographics, they get their news from all over the place. So mainstream media is still quite powerful, but it is becoming less relevant as time goes on. But I've been in Perth for several months now, and we know how negative the media can be when the Labor Party is in office, whether that's at the federal level or the state level. But every single day of the week, the West Australian newspaper has got a high level of anti-Albanese and anti-Labor material in its pages. On some days, it's a cartoon always showing Albanese as an inexperienced bumbling idiot. It's a negative headline about causing the high costs of living, Albanese causing higher interest rates, or a negative article about spending too much time overseas, even though this is all essential work and repairing the damage caused by the Morrison government to many international relationships Australia has in the world, as you referred to before, David. Anthony Albanese is going to Fiji next week, and he does run the risk of feeding into that narrative that's been created by the media of Albanese spending too much time overseas. And once these narratives are set, it's very difficult to shake them off. But the Labor government, in my opinion, it just has to keep following through with what their agenda is and keep doing what they have to do, and absolutely ignore the media when they try and fester these narratives. And the issue to take into account here is, if the media isn't complaining about overseas travel or Albanese not spending enough time in Australia, they'll always find something else to complain about. And they've even found the time to complain about Albanese's partner, Jodie Hayden, attacking her for suggesting a change of date for Australia Day, pointing out that her and Albanese are unmarried and that Albanese is a divorcee. And you sort of think, well, hang on, it's 2022, and this is what occupies the minds of the media. And I guess that this is the lot of Labor prime ministers. They will be attacked in ways that Liberal prime ministers are never attacked. They'll be scrutinised far more carefully. Their partners will be scrutinised. They'll be criticised for doing a good job. And it seems that for the mainstream media, a Labor prime minister will never be as good as a Liberal Party prime minister, irrespective of how bad that Liberal prime minister is.
Yeah. One of the classy things that the prime minister did in his acceptance speech was acknowledge the mother of his son, Carmel Tebbutt. I don't think he really had to do that, except his son was on the stage. And I don't know any of the circumstances of what led to the split. There was a bit of reporting in the newspaper, but it's really none of anybody's business, unless he'd given his current partner a job in somebody else's office at taxpayers' expense, before people start saying, oh, but you were really hard on Barnaby Joyce. I was only hard on Barnaby Joyce when he started improperly using his position to advantage his latest partner. Before then, what went on between Mr. and Mrs. Joyce was nobody's business. And it's the same with Anthony Albanese and Jodie Hayden, who is essentially playing the, we'll call it, fungible role of Prime Minister's wife or Prime Minister's partner, not First Lady. And she makes her opinions known about certain things. She's allowed to do this, and we're allowed to discuss them and critique them. But to give the sense that she's not entitled to do this because she's not married to him seems to me to be at least 50 years out of date. Seems to me to be horribly patriarchal, pretty sexist, and a bit misogynist. So should the date be changed? It's not as if she's saying, you know, something hideously offensive. And it's not as if she said something terribly insensitive about a marginalised group.
Well, Parliament is returning on the 26th of July. That's a couple of weeks' time. And that's when the real work of this next term of office commences. And all of these criticisms of overseas travel or media attacks on the Prime Minister's partner or any other superfluous issues, most of these will wash away. The public just isn't interested in them at the moment. The first 2 months after an election result, especially if there's been a change of government, is all about the government starting to paint the picture of what type of government it will be over the next parliamentary term. And I think until then, most of the work in politics is just political window dressing and people just getting used to their new positions in Parliament.
Yeah, and we haven't had the scandals yet of new ministers overstepping their mark. This may not happen, but most new governments, someone tends to overstep the mark and there's a resignation or two. Overstep in travel, it's a minister being too big for their boots. It's someone who maybe shouldn't have been promoted being in way out of their depth. It's been a pretty strong performance so far.
It was also revealed during the week how much the different factions within the New South Wales Liberal Party affected the outcome of the recent federal election. It was mainly the influence of the centre-right faction led by Alex Hawke and Scott Morrison. The three main groupings of the Liberal Party are three enemies that are eternal war with each other, and that sounds a little bit like Orwell's 1984, and that's the moderates, the conservatives, and the centre-right. And their inability to accommodate these differences cost them dearly at the last election. And there is a perception that the Labor Party is the one that has all the problems with factions. Labor factional warfare has been brutal in the past and has conspired to keep them out of office for many years in the post-war era and helped remove themselves when they were actually in government between 2010 and 2013. But the factional warfare, when it gets out of hand, is actually far more lethal in the Liberal Party. And there are some brutal characters within the New South Wales and Victoria branches of the Liberal Party who would rather go into opposition than see their internal rivals take control of the party. There were many factors that caused the last election loss for the Liberal Party, but I think that these factional fights were the major contributor.
The party was suing itself in the New South Wales Supreme Court over membership, whether a party could pre-select members from outside or whether you needed a strong internal process. When it came down to it, I agreed with the court that the internal workings of the Liberal Party, provided that they are legal and ethical, shouldn't be ordained by what the court says. And while the ethics are maybe questionable, the Prime Minister and a small cabinet pre-selecting people in certain seats isn't something that the law can do very much about, I don't think. So I think, as much as I would have liked to see the other side win, I couldn't see how they could, unless they could prove illegality, really. And again, the court shouldn't pronounce on ethics, because ethics is one thing and the law is another. The talk on the town was that this came out after, that Scott Morrison was widely loathed by the rest of the cabinet, with a couple of exceptions. Quotes after the election came out talking about how lowly they thought of him and that he refused to listen to any advice and ran a disastrous campaign. Now, there's a little bit of disingenuousness here too, I think, in that, for understandable reasons, the party wanted to pin all the blame on Morrison so that they can say, we've got rid of him, he's still on the backbench, but we all know that he's going to step down soon. He's tried a few media opportunities. There was that thing of him bowling, but mostly he's being ignored by the press. I don't know the full details. I don't need to know the full details. He's an irrelevancy and he's yesterday's man, which is part of the reason. But it's also the fact that I think that the senior non-Labor voices in the country are trying to pin 100% of the blame on him so that they can present themselves as a new party.
Well, Scott Morrison has been very quiet since the last election, and there was some speculation that he was going to retire from politics. But I think that if someone in politics is being too quiet, there's probably some trouble brewing in the background, and he's gone back to being the backroom operator. Now, he might be irrelevant as far as the electorate is concerned, but he's doing other things within the Liberal Party at the moment. He's trying to get like-minded people pre-selected into winnable seats for the Liberal Party. Morrison was the New South Wales Liberal Party campaign director before he entered Parliament, and most of his time was spent at that time trying to get his factional allies into New South Wales Parliament. He wasn't successful then. But the type of people Morrison wants to get into Parliament, into the Liberal Party, are people like Catherine Deaves. And she was the unsuccessful Liberal Party candidate in the seat of Warringah. And people like this are divisive culture war warriors who, based on the recent federal election, they're almost unelectable. And for the federal Liberal Party, this has got the potential to be a repeat of what happened in New South Wales politics for the Liberal Party. And they were out of office between 1995 and 2011, that's 16 years. They were mainly unelectable for most of that time, and different factional wars played out in public for most of that time as well.
We're seeing, I think, it's something deeper going on. Maybe it's the old right that starts with essentially John Howard in 1977. They have these brutal civil wars through the 80s. The neo-lib dry faction win really in the 90s, and they hold on to it till 2022, really. They should have been destroyed in 2007. And I guess the tactical mistake of Rudd was to try and keep Murdoch on his side. And that's an understandable mistake at that point, but it meant that Murdoch wasn't neutralised and that the Tony Abbott faction could control the party for the next 13 years. But now Murdoch has been effectively neutralised. And so we're seeing this change in the Australian polity. It's not to say that Australia will suddenly become a left-wing socialist paradise at all, but that far-right agenda-setting faction is losing. And this is what the problem with Scott Morrison trying to get his allies pre-selected is. They're not electable. You can pre-select as many people as you like, but if they don't get elected, it means nothing.
It's also hard to know what comes first, the factional problems or the electoral problems. And I think focusing too much on factions within the Liberal Party denies all of those other issues that caused them to lose the election, a lack of action on climate change, corruption, mismanagement, general incompetence. Now, all parties have their divisions and all parties have their subgroupings according to ideological pursuits and personalities within those subgroupings, but competence in politics is based around how those divisions and conflicts are managed. And generally, divisions and conflicts are always going to subside when a new government arrives in office, and electoral success is the best way of keeping those issues in check. But if those factional differences are not managed, a party starts to unravel and starts to lose its relevance to the public, as the Labor Party found out in 2013 and as the Liberal Party found out in 2022.
The Labor Party keeps learning this lesson. 1917, 1931, 1954, 1996, 1975 to a lesser extent, 2013. It's going to be interesting to see what happens with the Liberal Party. The Liberal Party tend not to split as such. They tend to reorganise the cupboards, clear out the dead wood and come back in. I suspect that we might get not a reorganisation but a total rebuild of the party. And two parties might come out of this and we may have an electoral war to see which ones become dominant again. Scott Morrison has suggested a moderate party. Did he call it the Progressive Party after totally misunderstanding what progressive was? And so I suspect for those of us who enjoy policy, who enjoy political philosophy, something is about to happen because I don't think Peter Dutton was the smartest choice to move forward.
You're listening to New Politics. You can subscribe to us on Apple or Google Podcasts, listen through YouTube, SoundCloud and Amazon Music, or find us at newpolitics.com.au, and you can now support New Politics through Patreon.
NAIDOC Week, and that's a celebration of the history, culture and achievements of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples all across Australia. It's also a symbol of resistance and survival of Indigenous people since 1788. There's still a long way to go, but Victoria is the first state to have advanced developments in a treaty between a government and First Nations people, and this is a process that has been pushed by First Nations people and the Victoria government, as well as the Victoria Liberal Party. For the federal government, the process is more difficult because anything to legally recognise a treaty with First Nations people or a voice to parliament needs to be passed by a referendum. Labor is supportive of a voice to parliament. Albanese announced this on election night and wants this process concluded within their first term of office. But we also have to remember that John Howard, Tony Abbott and Bob Hawke, they also made election night promises to offer more recognition of Indigenous rights, and not much came out of that. But it seems that this could be the most favourable time to implement an Indigenous voice to Parliament.
I think now is the time. It's going to take a while. Let's be frank, racists are calling it a third chamber, which will give more control to a minority of people. It's not about that at all. Again, New Zealand has had Indigenous representation and under extremely conservative governments, and nobody really complained. I know that the Treaty of Waitangi has issues about it and there's still people upset that it wasn't enough, but it was a step or three further than what we had in Australia, and we need to heal our relationships with our Indigenous people. We have the oldest society in the world. I get really frustrated when people say, oh, Australia's only got 240 years of history. That's correct, if you ignore the 60,000 years of history before then. Just because it's not written down in a way we can understand doesn't mean it didn't exist and doesn't mean that it's not vital and important and shapes what we are as modern Australians, both in very positive ways and also in very negative ways in terms of what happened after 1788. And all this has to be acknowledged and dealt with. And a voice in there that is able to represent a group of people, as best as anyone can represent a diverse and varied group of people. Don't forget there were 260 nations before 1788, so there's going to be all those opinions. Of course, racist publications like The Australians use disagreement to say that, oh, Indigenous people can't manage things. The Liberal Party, look how well-run an organisation that is, for example. And that's just a start. And I get really frustrated with that, in that if you are not white, you're not allowed to have a different opinion from somebody else of the same background of yourself. Of course you are. You know, there are Indigenous members of the Liberal Party. There are Indigenous members of the Labor Party. There's Indigenous members of the Greens. And there are apolitical Indigenous people. It doesn't matter. The key word when it comes to politics is people, which is not to, of course, to deny Indigenous background or I don't see colour or any of that quietly racist stuff.
Bob Hawke did say that his biggest regret when he was Prime Minister was not being able to secure a treaty with Indigenous people, but he hardly even tried. Too many Prime Ministers have made the promise, but in every case it's other matters that get in the way, it's too politically difficult, and not too many politicians are prepared to lose political skin over it. And it does take political courage, as Paul Keating showed in the 1992 Redfern speech.
The starting point might be to recognise that the problem starts with us, the non-Aboriginal Australians. It begins, I think, with an act of recognition. Recognition that it was we who did the dispossessing. We took the traditional lands and smashed the traditional way of life. We brought the diseases and the alcohol. We committed the murders. We took the children from their mothers. We practiced discrimination and exclusion. It was our ignorance and our prejudice and our failure to imagine that these things could be done to us.
And follow that up with the Native Title Act in response to the High Court's Mabo decision in 1992. And of course, the Native Title legislation was a compromise and didn't go anywhere near as far as it could have gone or as far as it should have gone, but it was a start. And I guess this is the conundrum with any constitutional legal change, that land rights or legal rights given back to the original owners of this land have to be agreed to by the people that took it away in the first place. So it's a moral issue as well. But there's a lot of compromise and there's so many constitutional hurdles that have to be overcome before any of this can happen.
Yeah. A third chamber, which it's not, even a representative, however they want to do it, the best way to do it is through referendum, I think. Having said that, that's probably the hardest way to do it. But then again, the most successful referendum that was ever passed in Australia was the 1967 referendum to pass Indigenous affairs from the states into the federal. So if it gets bipartisan support, and Peter Dutton may not be the right man to have bipartisan support with, it should pass. I suspect there is a feeling for change, and I suspect that if it's properly done and well explained, we'd get a majority of people in a majority of states.
Well, Julian Lisa is the Shadow Attorney General and the Shadow Minister for Indigenous Affairs. He's been quite positive about a voice to Parliament and constitutional recognition for Indigenous people, but more recently his support has been a little bit more muted. Now, he's a relative newcomer in the senior parts of the Liberal Party. He doesn't have that much clout. But again, it's that dilemma of having to get the support of a Conservative Party that is opposed to the voice of Parliament. And you mentioned this before, David, that we have to remember that whenever it has been brought up in the past, they've erroneously claimed that it's a third chamber of Parliament when it's clearly not. Now, there is that groundswell of support for the voice to Parliament. And the Liberal Party cannot just continue to be a party of opposition, even though they've been having quite a lot of success over the years, whether they've been in actual opposition or in government. And it's also an opportunity for the Liberal Party to move forward on Indigenous affairs. They've always claimed that they don't want to support empty symbolism and then use that as an excuse to not do anything at all. But this is way past empty symbolism. It's constitutional recognition. And if Conservatives value the Constitution as the pinnacle of the Australian political system, then they should support the voice of Parliament and facilitate the transition of this into constitutional law.
Yes, but then logic and consistency isn't a strong point of the Liberal right.
You're listening to New Politics. You can subscribe to us on Apple or Google Podcasts, listen through YouTube, SoundCloud and Amazon Music, or find us at newpolitics.com.au, and you can now support New Politics through Patreon.
There's no point in asking, you'll get no reply. And just remember, I don't decide. I got no reason, it's all too much. And you'll always find me out to lunch. And we're so pretty, oh so pretty. We're vacant and we're so pretty. Oh,
and in the lead up to the return of Parliament on July the 26th, there's some simmering tensions about climate change and who's got the mandate on emissions reductions. Labor did propose a reduction of 43% to emissions by 2030. The Australian Greens have proposed a reduction of 75% to emissions. Labor did win the election with 77 seats. The Australian Greens have got 4 seats, but they do hold the balance of power in the Senate, and Labor needs the support of the Greens to pass legislation. Now, there's absolutely no question that a whole lot more needs to be done on climate change action, and a lot of this action should have commenced well over 30 years ago, and it might even be a case where the 75% reduction of emissions by 2030 proposed by the Australian Greens, that might not actually be enough. But this is always going to be a political tightrope. Labor needs to be more proactive on climate change, but risks opening up the climate change wars again with the Liberal Party, and then we end up with nothing. And I've always thought that 43% of something is better than 100% of nothing. But is it a case of achieving what's politically possible or being far more ambitious and risk losing everything?
We can't expect the Greens to just do exactly what Labor says. But we can expect them to be able to work towards their goals. And I know that there is urgency in this stuff. We saw the last time that they dug in, we got Tony Abbott as Prime Minister. Labor has all these interests to balance. They have a lot of miners, and I mean proper miners, not Matt Canavan, put the hat on type rubbish, but actual people who get their hands dirty, who are members. The CFMEU is a major part of Labor. And I know too, a lot of miners do want to see emissions reduced, but not at the cost of their future. Things are possible. Things are able to be done. Things can be managed. But with the Greens, I would start to think about what the compromises are and see what they can live with. Now, I know a lot of Greens people too are going to say, we can't live with anything. This is really important and really vital. And this is the rub, isn't it? So I'm not saying here, oh, Labor is 100% right and should bow down to the Greens. And I'm also not saying that the Greens are 100% right and should bow down to Labor. But small steps done quickly are probably better than one giant step done too late.
And I think there is a long way to go on this, and we have to just see how all of this plays out. But my feeling is that it would be better to have an unambiguous target of 43%, because that's what was taken to the electorate by the Labor Party, but also include some creative legislative mechanisms to increase that over the next few years. Otherwise, there will be a debate that grinds down to a level of political grandstanding that will mean that we're stuck with the current low rates. And it's also that question of who has the mandate. And the answer is that both the Labor government and the Greens have a mandate to act according to what they've promised to their respective voting groups, a 43% target from the Labor Party and a 75% target promised by the Greens. But the practicalities are that the Labor Party is the elected government, not the Greens. But there's also other events that come into play. And the current Sydney floods are the fourth round of major floods on the eastern seaboard this year. And it's this awareness and perceptions of the Sydney floods that can be used to argue the case politically for a higher target to reduce emissions. And there's absolutely no question that levels of emissions reduction have to be far greater than what's being proposed. But the problem is that it's not the environment that makes these decisions. It's the people that are elected to make these decisions. And quite often, these are fallible and very compromised people that are trying to make these decisions.
Yeah, it's all very well to argue over 43%, 75% when your house is underwater. And this is the fourth time in 12 months or less even that we've had these once in 100 year rains. Now, I haven't seen it yet, but I'm pretty sure that there are those who are opposed to any cuts in emissions saying once in 100 years only means that it's the chance of it happening. So it's like rolling four sixes in a row on a dice. That's not quite the point here.
Well, I managed to do that when I was a kid, but as an adult, no.
Exactly. And so we are definitely at crisis point. No question about that. I noticed today that Foster and Tuncurry are under get-ready-to-act orders. Lismore, again, in far north New South Wales, is flooded again. People are just starting to move back in and have had to move back out. Sydney is cut off from itself. Nature is far more powerful than humanity. That's the lesson of the last 20,000 years of civilization. Nature always wins.
So climate change is a critical issue now. It's actually been a critical issue over the past 30 or 40 years. And it was the greatest moral challenge of our time in 2007. That was the message that was put out by Kevin Rudd. But now it's become the greatest economic challenge as well. And I've always felt that framing it as a moral issue was a mistake. Politics never does very well at resolving moral issues at all. Once economics and finances get involved, that's when politicians start taking more interest, although it can also result in a downfall, which is exactly what happened with the carbon pricing mechanism in 2013. But this is an area generally that needs to be carefully managed, and especially in the context of the third interest rate rise in 3 months and a rise in inflation. If there are more financial pressures on the electorate, and there's an expectation that the government needs to act upon this, they're less likely to support climate change action. Scott Morrison actually alluded to this during the last election campaign, that he had research to suggest that once people realised the personal costs of climate change measures in dollar terms, they were less likely to support this climate change action. And I wouldn't trust anything that Scott Morrison said about climate change, and he was using this research to support his inaction on climate change action during all of the time that he was in government. But there still is that point that the politics of climate change has to be managed very, very, very carefully. And it's not like the opposition just sits there, they watch on and does nothing. They're waiting for openings or chinks in any government debate. They're looking to score political points against the government on the costs of climate change, on Indigenous affairs, or anything else that they can get their hand on. And that's generally what political parties do. And just because the Liberal Party lost the last election, that doesn't mean that their behaviour is going to change. They're a conservative reactionary party, and this is what conservative reactionary political parties do.
Yeah, exactly. They're not openly, they're not being driven by ideology first. Now, of course, you can take ideology too far, but their ideology is small government. It's personal responsibility, whatever that is. It's freedom, whatever that is. But their main thing is to get into government for the power. They're not interested in freedom and personal responsibility for the people they don't like, only for their own selves. And again, trying to get a definition of any of this out of them is an interesting exercise in circular semantics. They will do and try anything within their ideological framework. And I'll be fair, there's a sense in which they're consistent in this. There's nothing they won't try or do or say. A few of them have been reborn as moderates. A few of them have been reborn as environmentalists. And for free marketeers, the market is suggesting a move to renewable energy, a move to solar, a move to water, a move to wind, and a move away from gas and oil and coal. But the ideology doesn't stretch that far, apparently.
That's it for this episode of New Politics. Thanks for listening in. If you'd like to support our style of journalism and commentary, please make a donation at our website at newpolitics.com.au. We don't beg, plead, beseech or gaslight you about journalism coming to an end. We just keep it very simple. If you like what we do, please send some support our way. It keeps our commitment to independent journalism ticking along. I'm Eddie Djokovic. Thanks for listening in, and it's goodbye to our listeners.
I'm David Lewis. We'll see you next time.